From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Around the world, the market for gold is beyond sparkling these days. At nearly $500 an ounce, it's blazing, and it's pushing the gold mining industry to amazing lengths to pull new gold from the earth. Measures so extreme that critics are now calling the fruit of these mines dirty gold. Vast open pits, ravaged landscapes, cyanide-drenched horizons. Demand is pushing mining operations after the tiniest flecks at enormous cost in Montana, Peru, Indonesia, worldwide. The New York Times this week published the first two installments in a series about the gold mining industry that raised many questions about the lengths to which the world is going for gold. We're taking a closer look. This hour on Point, the real cost of gold. You can join the conversation. Did you know it takes 30 tons of earth blasted and drizzled with cyanide to make that ring on your finger? How far will humans go to tear tinier and tinier flecks of gold from the planet? Is this good business or bad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Upper Saddle River, New Jersey, is Bill O'Neill. He's managing director of Logic Advisors, a research and brokerage firm. He's former managing director of commodity research at Merrill Lynch, where he followed gold. Mr. O'Neill, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've all learned a lot this week in the Times about how the gold is pulled out of the planet. Tell us about the market, the demand that's pulling it. What's the surge? Where's it come from?
Well, we have a general speculative demand that's come into the market. Also, we are seeing very strong jewelry demand as nations such as India and China grow in their wealth. We're seeing renewed demand from these traditional buyers of the metal. And a major event in recent months and really the last couple of years is the hedge fund community and the fund community in general coming in, buying baskets of commodities, and gold is one of the premier commodities that they buy. So that is adding to the strength of the market.
Let's look at the consumer demand for a moment. We read that 80% of gold mined today is used for jewelry. So it's still the glitter on the ear or the finger or around the neck that would seem to be the number one driver. Is that right?
That's true, but also we're seeing accumulation of gold bullion, for example, and buying for investment purposes. For many years, the European investor, who has been a major buyer historically, was out of the market. We're seeing them come back in a very strong way. Also, with the oil revenues that some of the Middle Eastern nations are achieving, they're coming in. They're also longtime traditional investors. We're seeing buying from there as well. So there are a number of sources coming in the confluence of events that are rallying the market.
Talk about those events. Hedge funds are pretty savvy investors. For a long time, gold was kind of a snoozeville, and now it's so hot. What are the big global economic trends or events that are pushing hedge funds, for example, to want to grab it up?
Well, I think there's a great deal of uncertainty. Really, since September 11th, there's been a tremendous fear and uncertainty surrounding various markets. People want to hold hard assets, and gold certainly has been a beneficiary of that. Other commodities also, the energy markets, for example, crude oil, also has a speculative element in that. So people want to be in these hard assets. They don't want to be in paper as much as they did previously.
There's concern now about the oil price spike potentially driving inflation. Does that push demand for gold?
Yes, certainly there is. Gold usually tells us ahead of time if there's an inflation, and some of the recent rally in gold, I think, is reflecting a creeping inflation that some people really aren't planning on or haven't predicted. But I think gold is telling us, yes, there is some inflation ahead, and it may be more than people think.
Is this a short-term interest, infatuation, as you see it? Or in this century, it seems ironic. It's such an old kind of medieval-sounding, you know, thing to hang on to. But in the 21st century, do you see gold being a big deal? Do you see prices going way over $500 an ounce?
Well, I don't think it's short-term, you know, depending on what your definition of short-term is. But I think this is going to be continuing for a couple of years. And, you know, as they say, you have to learn from the lessons of history. And historically, gold has been a very good store of value during times of concern. So I think it's a cycle, yes, but the cycle could go on for quite a while.
And what about the ratio of the sort of, on the one hand, you have new production of gold. On the other hand, you have a lot of gold sitting in vaults. The United States holding more than anybody else. $122 billion worth of gold in U.S. vaults, 8,134 tons. As demand rises, does it? What's the big factor here? Does it? I mean, it's clearly hard to get gold now. So do we just keep go? Do we go on mining it, or does the value of what's in the vaults just go up? Do you see what I'm driving at?
I think it'll be a combination of both. One of the problems is that many of the mines are old, for example, in South Africa. So it's more difficult and more expensive to do the mining. So, yes, production likely will not go up significantly. If there is a huge increase in demand, it will be difficult for the production side to meet that.
They're pulling such microscopic bits of gold out of the earth now. Is there a point at which, as a business proposition, mining companies give up on it, that it just becomes too expensive to pull it out and too environmentally damaging?
Absolutely, and we've seen that. You mentioned Snoozeville a little earlier as a part of what gold was for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And U.S. mines, for example, stopped, and it became unprofitable. So, yes, there is certainly a business point, but with the prices going up recently, we're seeing more and more efforts to get gold from pretty much any place they can get it.
It's almost $500 an ounce now. What are you telling your clients? What are you advising them? Still buy gold?
Yes, I think the market should be bought on weakness. It's going to be a choppy market. It's not going to go straight up, but I think you should buy on weakness. I think the market probably has a range of this is a very broad range now, of maybe 440 on the bottom and maybe 550 to 575 on the top.
There's the word from the financial advisor, buy gold. Bill O'Neill, Managing Director at Logic Advisors, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to turn now to Kirk Johnson. He joins us from Denver, Colorado. He's New York Times bureau chief there and one of the reporters who worked on the Cost of Gold series for the New York Times that began to run this week. Kirk Johnson, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is a real head-turning piece. I guess for people who pay attention, they've known this is going on, but you've laid out in incredible detail exactly what's happening here. Describe for us the basics of gold mining today and what it takes to produce fresh gold from the earth.
Well, what we really came away with through months of work on this project is how much of a combination of promise and peril at the same time the industry faces. The profits that are being made from the prices of gold at this level are pushing them to places that as your previous guest indicated, mm-hmm. That they wouldn't have gone before. At the same time, it's a shrinking planet. Local communities and non-government organizations around the world have more clout and savvy than ever before. And in critiquing, as they do, a process that can have these huge environmental consequences for a product that is ever more discretionary, either for investment or gold or jewelry,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time, you know, the greater role of the brand name process for retailers and image consciousness for companies, and the result really is this greater vulnerability that we found in among retailers who are increasingly concerned, with some of them, about what customers are going to want and how corporate image is going to be affected.
Even the chairman of Tiffany's, which has moved a lot of gold in its time, saying maybe we're going too far. You and your fellow reporters pretty eloquent in describing the what you describe as the element of madness that's always been there in gold's allure, driving people to the outer edges of desire to have it, hoard it, kill or conquer for it, possess it like a lover. You quote King Ferdinand of Spain in the early 1500s, laying down the priorities for his conquistadors, saying, get gold, humanely if possible, but at all costs, get gold. Tell us, what does it take today, Kirk? Just the physical process of retrieving these microscopic flecks. What's the basic process?
Well, the physical process basically depends on volume. When the specks of gold are that fine, ultimately it means moving huge, immense amounts of rock to get it, and then processing that in giant open spaces. For example, a mine I visited here in Colorado, these giant trucks that can carry 300 tons of ore.
300 tons in one truck?
In one truck, per trip.
Wow.
And working around the clock, they will bring up about 200 loads every 24 hours.
This is from an open pit mine.
This is an open pit mine.
And what do they do with that raw ore?
The ore there is then ground into chunks maybe about the size of a quarter or so, mm-hmm. and deposited on what's called a heap leach pad, which can be 3, 4, 5 story high mound of millions of tons of this ore.
That is then drenched in?
As a diluted cyanide water solution.
And the cyanide does what, Kirk?
It basically chemically bonds and dissolves the gold out of the rock. And it then trickles down to the bottom of this pad, where it's kind of whooshed along to the processing mill, where the cyanide is stripped back out.
And the gold remains. And these open pits, what scale are we talking about? What size?
It's almost unimaginable to stand on the edge of some of these places. Most of them are in the middle of nowhere, so very few people see them. They're not on the tourist haunts of the world.
You might see them from the moon, it sounds like. And the cyanide, what happens to it after all those gallons are drenched here?
It's mostly recovered and is then recycled back through the system again. There have been spills. The industry says that these were learning curves and aberrations that have been corrected in recent years.
Kirk, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're riding learning curves on the real price of gold. Kirk Johnson with the New York Times is with us. We'll hear a lot more voices. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking in this hour about the real price of gold, what it takes to mine it from the earth these days. You can join the conversation. Did you know it took 30 tons of earth blasted, soaked in cyanide, to make the ounce, the ring on your finger, to make one gold band? And how far will humans go to tear tinier and tinier flecks of gold from the planet? Does it make you rethink the band of gold mystique? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Kirk Johnson, New York Times bureau chief in Denver, one of the authors of a new New York Times series on this quest for gold and the extremes to which it's going. Kirk Johnson, you report that it is jewelry, demand for jewelry. Above all, we've heard Bill O'Neill, formerly of Merrill Lynch, on how investors are driving this, but demand up in 1 year, 47% in India, 11% in China, lots of new wealth in these countries. The U.S., a huge consumer as well, but the demand for jewelry that's driving this.
Yes, it's jewelry, but it's also tradition to a certain degree that has merged with middle class affluence in parts of India. What we found there is gold has a deep, ancient, traditional role in Indian society, and that the economic growth there in recent years has put more and more Indians in a position of being able to buy it for ceremonial purposes and weddings and other cultural events, but also as a store of value, as it has often been.
So at one time, as you say, gold was the basis for the strength of empires and currencies, but now it's much more individually driven by that demand for jewelry by tradition. 80% of the gold mined today coming mined to satisfy the demand for jewelry. What about in the United States and globally the environmental constraints on the gold mining industry? Is it clean, dirty? Does it end up a huge open pit, but a clean open pit and leach pad or not, Kirk?
Well, it has varied dramatically from place to place. And certainly one of the things that we have found is that with one of the things that has shaped the industry is the lack of a federal organizing jurisdictional role over it. So that it differs greatly from state to state as to how environmental regulations and rules are put into place and what's required what has been required for reclamation of open pits once they're created.
You write that hard rock mining generates more toxic waste than any other industry in the U.S. and that gold generates more waste per ounce than any other metal.
The Environmental Protection Agency's figures based on waste produced by industry really put hard rock mining out there on an extreme point. The industry says that those numbers are kind of an exaggeration because it's basically rock, they say. It was dug out of the ground and it becomes waste by virtue of the process, but they dispute how toxic or how accurate it is to characterize it as waste. But the EPA says it's a toxic material.
The industry says people want gold and we're just moving rock around to get it. Kirk Johnson, please stand by if you would. I want to welcome a couple more voices into our conversation. Joining us from New Haven, Connecticut is Pyle Sumput. She is International Campaign Director for a group called Earthworks, an environmental organization that runs the No Dirty Gold campaign, along with Oxfam America. Pyle Sumput, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Denver, Colorado, Anne Maist, a geochemist and vice president at Buca Environmental, an energy and environmental consulting company. Anne Maist, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Pyle Sumput, your group has helped raise awareness about gold mining and cast it in very dire terms. What's your view of what's going on with gold mining today and the cost of those rings on our fingers and necklaces that people wear?
Well, like you said, it's hard to imagine that something as shiny and seemingly innocuous as a gold ring has in fact left 20 tons or 30 tons of mine waste in its wake. And much of this gold mining in many places is also linked to human rights and social abuses. For instance, more than half of gold that's mined today comes from indigenous people's lands in places as diverse as Nevada and Peru and Australia. And the No Dirty Gold campaign, which is a joint campaign of Earthworks and Oxfam, is calling on the mining industry to stop using practices that endanger people and ecosystems to clean up the way that gold is mined.
What are the social consequences? Does it make these communities rich when they find gold on their traditional lands?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, mining-dependent communities and countries are, in fact, among the poorest in the world, according to economists. Many of these companies extract millions of dollars worth of metals from indigenous lands, externalizing the environmental costs. In other words, leaving the burden of the cleanup, in many cases, to taxpayers and communities, and paying back a tiny fraction of the worth of metal in royalties or payments to local governments.
And what about the environmental impact? Kirk Johnson describes a process where, yes, tons of rock are moved, yes, it's soaked in cyanide, but the cyanide is reprocessed and doesn't sound so bad when you put it that way.
Right. Well, by the mining industry's own reporting, voluntary reporting, actually, in the United States, metals mining is the number one toxic polluter in the country, beating even the chemicals industry in terms of emissions of mercury, lead, arsenic, and other chemicals into air, soil, and water. And what's more, many of the practices that are used by the mining industry are simply archaic and really wouldn't be accepted in more public industries, in industries that were more visible to consumers. For example, in places like Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, U.S. and Canadian companies are dumping mine wastes directly into the ocean or into rivers. Some of these open pit mines, sulfuric acid is generated in perpetuity. That's forever. And the costs of cleanup are really prohibitive and, as I said earlier, typically passed on to taxpayers and governments.
Anne Maist, you've consulted plenty to the mining industry and others. I mean, we read the stories in the Times and they're eye-popping, this spill in Romania. In ultimately the Danube River, mine waste, 1,600 miles out into the Black Sea. Pyle Sumput mentions Papua New Guinea. We read there that one of the world's biggest mining company, BHP Billiton, pulled out of a profitable mine because the mining was not compatible with its environmental values for a mining company. That must be saying something. So is this a zone of destruction where gold mining goes on today, or is it acceptable?
Well, there are many adverse environmental impacts from gold mining, but as Kirk mentioned earlier, it's a bit of a mixed bag. It really depends what I call inherent qualities of the mine. If the rock will make the sulfuric acid and it's located close to surface water or groundwater, then it's much more likely that you're going to have polluted water nearby. And some of the mines in Nevada, which is the biggest mining state in this country for gold, don't fit into that category, but some of them do. So
you mean the category of being close to groundwater, to drinking water? Is that what you mean?
Right. And a lot of those mines, groundwater is 200 feet deep. So what we have there is delayed impacts. So in 6 or 7 generations, we're going to see impacts to groundwater, but not right away.
So we're fine now, but what the scores, hundreds of years down the road, people will be dealing with the wetting bands that we bought today.
That's what we've determined by doing modeling and some other testing on these mine sites. On the other hand, there are mines that we see very bad environmental problems right now. So it's a mixed bag.
The Times is reporting, Kirk Johnson and others, that the industry has unveiled a new code this month for dealing with the cyanide, the real problem here. But that cyanide code is voluntary, not enforced by government. How widely do you think it's going to be observed, Ann?
A lot of the measures that we see coming out are voluntary in the mining industry. And I think there are some real leaders in the mining industry, and they will probably step up to the plate and try to set an example. However, we also have what are called junior mining companies that are less financially stable and less willing to put a little extra money into environmental protection. But the costs of cleaning up environmental messes from mines are getting very high. So if you can prevent the pollution in the first place, you're going to be doing a better job, and that's certainly relevant to using cyanide.
And all this for jewelry, which is lovely, and for bullion that sits in vaults. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking about the real cost of gold. It's pretty eye-opening. Bill is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. What do you think?
Good morning. I just was interested. We had a mine here outside of Columbia that's been closed down for 10 years. There was a lot of controversy when it opened up. I think the company was forced to post some type of bond or insurance policy. They said they'd be here forever. They operated for, I guess, 6 or 7 years, closed up, left, and as it turns out, as I recall, it's a paper company and there are no assets for anybody to go against, and we have a toxic pond with a cyclone fence sitting around it, which I guess will be here forever, and eventually the local taxpayers will have to pay for it. And there seems to be no one overseeing anything to do with it.
And no company left to deal with that. And I think that is, in a nutshell, what we're hearing described right around the world. Bill, thanks very much for that call. Kirk Johnson, you pick up the story of a Montana town, the site of the Zortman-Landusky gold mine, with a rather similar tale to tell. Can you share it with us?
Sure. This the Zortman-Landusky pits were the first large-scale open-pit cyanide process mines when they opened in 1979. And the company went bankrupt in 1998 at a time when the water quality issues were emerging as worse and worse, the consequences of the mining there, especially the acid drainage that was being produced from the heap leach pads. And the state is going to be in the position there of treating the water in perpetuity. They are creating a fund now that will take it into the next century, but there's no confidence that they won't need to do it beyond that. So it's a forever impact.
So gold mine company bankrupt, and there too the community left to clean it up. It's quite a picture. I want to turn right now, if I may, to Reno and Russ Fields. He's president of the Nevada Mining Association. Mr. Fields, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm sure you've been reading the New York Times series, and I'm sure it's not the first time any of these issues have come to your attention. You can imagine how it hits a layman's eye and mind reading this. It sounds like, whoa, maybe we should stop right away here. Is it as bad as all that?
Well, I think some of the things I've heard as I've been listening to the show certainly need to be addressed. The answer to your question is people need to understand that gold mining varies throughout the world. I'm really capable now of talking about what we do here in Nevada, what is done here in Nevada, and has been done for, you know, probably over 30 years, this relatively large-scale, microscopic gold mining. It's a mature industry out here in the sense that we've had this 25, 30 years of experience in correctly addressing many of the issues that have been addressed today. One of the things that goes with that level of experience is that our regulators, both state and federal, have also had substantial experience in dealing with the mining industry.
But does that mean that it's clean? Ann Maist is saying that even in Nevada, there may be a delayed impact 6 or 7 generations out when the cyanide ultimately trickles into groundwater and becomes an issue for broader communities. Is that your understanding of what the future holds here?
Well, there's measures that are taken even today to address things that may occur, say, generations from now. And that has to do with primarily dealing with the concern that has been raised by some of your guests on acid mine drainage.
But can you tell us with confidence that that won't be a problem? I mean, some places it's a problem now, but generations out, can we look upon gold mining with confidence that we're not leaving a legacy of cyanide-polluted groundwater?
Well, I don't think I'm worried about cyanide. In fact, I am not worried about cyanide. Cyanide is a very tenuous chemical that rapidly breaks down under a lot of conditions. And I think the scientists, regardless of what their views of gold mining are...
Where is your concern, then?
It's the issue that has been raised by, I think it was Pyle, talking about acid mine rock. That is something that we do need to address and have addressed. And the way the mines here in Nevada deal with that is we either cover the material with what's called a neutralizing form of rock, like a limestone, and that will neutralize the potential to form acid.
So that it doesn't get into the atmosphere and become part of an acid rain cycle.
Oh, yeah, right. No, I don't think you need to worry about that.
Ann Maist, are you as sanguine about cyanide? I thought I heard you say 6 or 7 generations. Russ Fields, unless I'm misunderstanding, is saying this is a kind of tenuous pollutant.
Well, maybe we should clarify that.
Please.
I think the issue is less with the cyanide and more with the acid drainage.
I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As
mm-hmm.
Russ was saying. Mm-hmm. Cyanide in surface environments is not that much of an issue. It has been in very extreme instances where it's released quickly into a river and you can have, like we had here in Colorado, 17 miles of dead stream.
Fish kills. Mm-hmm.
Fish kills. That was a mix of acid and cyanide. However, you know, in subsurface environments, cyanide can remain a problem in groundwater. But what I was talking about was more this acid drainage problem. It's a reaction that is hard to turn off once it turns on. And it can keep going. It's mining is very different than even, let's say, an electroplating facility where you can just turn off the faucet
right. And
you're done with the pollution. Mining, the material stays on the earth forever.
And the scale, as we've heard in this hour, is vast. We've got a lot to get to here. Kirk Johnson, we've just got you for another 20 seconds, and you've got more to come in your series. Are you optimistic about where this industry's headed, Kirk, in a word or no?
I think there could be definite elements of hope, and I think part of that comes in what people say is a perception that they are more vulnerable than, say, copper producers or other metal miners because of the kinds of products that they're producing, and I think there could be leadership from the industry.
Well, we thank you for raising awareness of it, Kirk Johnson with the New York Times. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
And Russ Fields, in Reno, Nevada, president of the Nevada Mining Association, thank you very much for your perspective, Mr. Fields.
Well, thank you very much.
Listeners, you can join us. We're talking about the real price of gold. We've got more voices, and we'd be happy to have yours. What do you think? Does our fascination with gold begin to look medieval? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real price of gold. You've been hearing what it takes to pull the tiny flecks out of the earth these days, the environmental consequences, the efforts to manage those consequences. What do you think? Is all gold now dirty gold, or is that too harsh? Is the glitter gone? With so many humans and just one earth, is every human obsession now dangerous? Or can we manage this? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Payal Sampat, International Campaign Director for Earthworks. She runs the No Dirty Gold campaign, along with Oxfam America. And also from Denver, Colorado, by Ann Mace, a consultant, geochemist, has worked a lot in the mining industry. Right now, Marion is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Marion, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm from Chile.
Yes.
And in Chile, there's a company called Barrick, which is a Canadian company, and they have decided that they are going to move a glacier from the Andes and to get to the gold that's underneath in a mountain.
That's large scale.
That's the scale. It's huge. And the problem is that they're going to leave all the piles of rock in Chile. They're going to take the gold, they're going to use the water from Chile, and this is northern Chile, right next to the Atacama Desert, which is extremely dry.
Yes.
And they're going to leave the poisons, the leaching, etc., there, and take the gold with them.
Marion, are you confident that the Chilean government will oversee this and make sure?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, the Chilean government has given them the go-ahead. The people of the area have been working extremely hard for the past 30 years to develop green valleys in that area, mm-hmm. to develop an olive oil industry, grape industry, and all of that is going to dry up if this continues.
Marion, what does that leave you thinking about the gold perhaps on your finger or around your neck or in your earlobe?
I barely use it. My father used to buy gold for my mother, and that's the only gold we've got, and I'm certainly not buying any.
We hear the story, and we've got it. Thank you, Marion. Payal Sampat, what do you make of this? We read in the Times that the World Bank continues to finance gold mining operations around the world. In a place like Chile or Peru, where the Times was reporting, are there environmental oversights that come along with that financing, that come along with the mining?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, this mine that Marion was describing in Chile, the Pascualama mine, is a really good example of that. And another good example is the story that Kirk Johnson and Joan Perlez tell in the New York Times of the Glamis gold mine in Guatemala. And that's a good example of a case where the World Bank has lent $45 million to this U.S.-Canadian mining company to build this gold mine in one of the poorest parts of Guatemala, a Mayan indigenous region, where the people are asking, well, you know, why didn't we get the money? Why wasn't the money given by the World Bank to poverty alleviation projects rather than to a first world mining company?
What's the World Bank rationale for that? With the price of gold so high, why is the World Bank financing gold mining? Why don't the companies do it themselves?
That's a good question. I mean, this is the private arm of the World Bank, which really functions like any other bank, and they're really interested in returns to their investments.
So they're looking for a return on investment, but there stand the people, and they may live with the consequences. It's quite a picture. Let's take another call. Alan is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Okay. I've been listening, and I've made a living for 40 years working underground, open pits, all the rest of them, I've worked in Honduras, Minnesota, Michigan, South Dakota, and then the coal mines and zinc mines in Tennessee.
So you've got a lot of experience. And what do you hear in this reporting on gold mining? Is it an accurate representation of what you've seen?
Well, 60-some years ago, I worked in Honduras in a big silver mine, and that was pretty rotten because of the way they treated the people. But some of the money went to Honduras because they had to pay off the politicians to do the work.
Well, yeah, and who knows where that money ended up. But what do you think, Alan, with all of your experience in the industry and with what we're hearing and reading today, you know, should we be, wearing wooden wedding bands instead of gold, or do you think it's on balance all right?
First of all, if we want to clean up pollution, they ought to go back to horses.
Yeah, there's a little matter of automobiles, but gold is...
Automobile industry. No, right here outside of Sumter, they had a Kennecott or one of them had a small pit. They went in there and cleaned out the gold that had been there for years, and nobody wanted to do it. They came in and did it. They hired a bunch of people, and they gave them good wages. They worked it all out. They used cyanide, and then filled in whatever they had to do, but there had been no complaints here.
But what about your distant neighbor there who called in, Bill from Columbia? Says he's got a pool of cyanide behind a chain-link fence and a bankrupt company.
A lot of these people have never been near a mine.
Well,
I spent my life in it.
Yeah, still, I guess a cyanide pool, well, you don't go swimming in it, but you probably know it when you see it.
How do these people know there's a cyanide pool? Kennecott is a good, responsible international company, and they don't go around lousing up the countryside and then walking away from it.
Well, it's good if they don't, but those that do are raising our eyebrows. Alan, we appreciate your call. I want to invite another Alan into our conversation right now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Alan Berger joins us. He is associate professor in the Graduate School of Design at Harvard University, author of Reclaiming the American West, has a very big view of the consequences of very large-scale industry and mining on the planet. Alan Berger, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
What's your view of what we're hearing here in the scars and perhaps the chemical consequences of gold mining in particular? Do you see a large-scale problem or something manageable?
Well, I hear quite a number of positions on gold mining, and when you take a sort of broader look at mining, I know you want me to comment on gold mining specifically, but there are many other types of mines that create quite a bit of landscape alteration, especially in the American West, which is where I look at mine and mine reclamation. I will say that, one of the issues that isn't being described or talked about are the abandoned mines across the world, and especially in the Intermountain West of the U.S.
And do you mean in chemical or pollution terms, or simply in the vast presence of the scar left?
Well, in many terms, whether it's a chemical composition that's been left over, whether it's a scar, whether it's a shaft, whether it's a structure. The American West has 500,000 abandoned and active mines.
Is that a problem, or just what we do as humans on this planet?
Well, it is what we do as humans on this planet, unfortunately, and I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon. And so I think what's critical to also describe for your program, Tom, is that abandoned mine issue is just as big or even bigger a problem than the current active mining situation being described by the guests.
But, of course, that's kind of a sunk cost. I mean, those mines are there. They're vast facts. It's the forward-going edge that we can do something about right now, I guess. Or have I got that wrong, Alan?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Abandoned mines really need to be paid for, as well as the sort of concurrent reclamation of active mines that are going on now. And in the large metal mining states, there's really no money to pay for them because the tax levied to coal mining really is what pays for the reclamation of abandoned mines. And abandoned mines, in coal mining states like Wyoming, are already all cleaned up. So a state like Arizona or a state like Nevada, which has abandoned metal mines, doesn't really have any funding from the Abandoned Mine Land Fund, which is coal money, essentially, to pay for reclaiming those abandoned mines.
Which makes it sound like a problem that could be sitting around for a very long time. I want to try and get one more call here. Kate's calling from Boston. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And also for having this discussion, raising awareness about this issue. I just have a couple comments or a question, actually.
Yeah.
I'm 25 years old. A lot of people my age are, of course, getting right now, getting married.
You said you're 25, Kate.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they're starting to, you know, do those things.
Sure.
And I'm seeing a lot of people just, you know, really throw themselves into this idea that they need these enormous diamonds and these beautiful things with gold and platinum and silver and everything. And,
a lot of tradition there, yeah.
A lot of tradition, but with the human toll from the diamond trade and the human and environmental toll from the gold trade, is there anything left that doesn't, you know, isn't marred by all of this, all these problems?
I mean, is there another metal or another jewel, but another metal that we could put around that finger to mark the marriage? It's a great question, yes. Kate. Pyle Sumpet, what's your group's answer to that question?
That's a great question. Many consumers are saying that, you know, the real price of gold is, in fact, very high, and particularly when you're making a purchase like a wedding ring, that's a symbol of your lifelong commitment. You want to make sure that it's not produced at the expense of communities and the environment.
Do you have a suggested option?
Well, that's why the No Dirty Gold campaign is really shining the spotlight as much on the jewelry firms who are selling these products as on the mining industry.
But what are you suggesting? To wear something other than gold or to ask where it came from and make sure it wasn't a dirty mine? Is that practical?
Absolutely. We are. We think consumers should be asking those questions. Where did this gold come from? How is it produced? How do I obtain fair trade or responsibly mined gold? And we want jewelers to be insisting that their suppliers provide them with these alternatives to dirty gold.
With a record all the way back, do you think that will happen, or are you going to try and wean people away from gold ultimately?
Well, we're not calling for a boycott on gold. We think that there is a lot of low-hanging fruit. There are a lot of practices that the gold mining industry is getting away with that would simply not be acceptable in other industries. I mentioned some of those earlier, like the dumping of mine waste into ocean or not fully paying up front for the costs of cleanup and closure that Alan was talking about. So we think that those changes are possible. It's possible to mine gold in ways that are far less destructive. But that impetus, that pressure really needs to come from the market. It needs to come from consumers like Kate. It needs to come from jewelry companies like Tiffany's or Cartier and others, some of whom are already stepping up and taking leadership positions, voicing their support for more responsibly produced gold.
The chairman of Tiffany's, Michael Kowalski, is saying reform urgently needed. You're saying no where the gold comes from. It sounds like a challenge, but maybe if consumers raise their voices, a kind of label will end up on here that will help them figure it out. We certainly learned a lot in this hour, and I want to thank all of you for being with us. Alan Berger in Ann Arbor, author of Reclaiming the American West, and it's an eye-popping book. I recommend it. Thank you very much, Alan, for being with us.
Thank you.
Ann Maist in Denver, Colorado, at Buca Environmental. Thank you for joining us, Ann.
Thank you, Tom.
And Pyle Sumpet with Earthworks and the No Dirty Gold Campaign. Pyle, thanks for being along.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. Click on forums. This is On Point. In Washington, the waiting game continues this morning, but not for much longer. At 2 p.m. Eastern, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is scheduled to hold a press conference on his CIA leak investigation. He is reportedly prepared to ask grand jurors to indict Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff. An indictment is not expected, at least for today, we're told, for President Bush's chief political advisor, Karl Rove. Of course, no one knows for certain what Mr. Fitzgerald will announce. Daniel Kleidman is Washington bureau chief for Newsweek magazine and keeping a close watch, as are many others today, on all these developments. He joins me now from Washington. Dan Kleidman, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So what exactly is expected at 2 p.m. today?
Well, it is being widely reported now that special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald will announce an indictment of at least Scooter Libby, R. Lewis Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, and it is also being widely reported that Karl Rove, the president's political advisor and deputy chief of staff, will not be indicted, at least today. His lawyer, Robert Luskin, has put out a statement that Rove's status remains unchanged and that Fitzgerald has not decided whether he will indict Rove. That doesn't mean that he's out of trouble. It just means that no decision, final decision, has been made. What we don't know is what the scope of these charges will be, whether others will be indicted along with Libby today.
And the charges expected against Libby, is it known, or are we just guessing?
We don't know. We're guessing. You know, grand jury investigations are sort of like, you know, icebergs. You can see a little bit of the tip, but the vast majority of what goes on is shrouded in secrecy, and we don't know whether, you know, the charges are going to be go directly to the underlying allegation that Libby or others unmasked the covert identity of Valerie Plame, the CIA operative, or if the charges will relate to somehow impeding the investigation by either lying to investigators, lying to the grand jury, or somehow obstructing the investigation. And there's also the possibility that there are conspiracy charges or other charges that we just never really knew about. So we're still in guessing mode here, even though we're only not long at all from knowing what happened.
And Dan, Karl Rove, no mean manipulator of political theater, waving and smiling to reporters this morning. Is there a chance that he's dodged a bullet here? That he's out of danger?
Well, not based on the statement that his own lawyer put out, which is that his status remains unchanged, that the prosecutors has not decided. It is true that generally prosecutors will not go out of their way to clear people. They'll simply they won't bring charges, and they'll generally say that the case remains under investigation. And so did Fitzgerald tell Luskin that his client was out of danger? Not according to the statement that that Luskin put out. So it looks like he's still in the danger zone, but may have gotten a reprieve. Rove apparently was out in front of his house today saying that today was going to be a fantastic day.
Yeah.
Well, not for Scooter Libby, not for the White House, not for Republicans in Washington.
And very briefly, Dan, what about Vice President Cheney? If his chief of staff is in the bullseye here, is he in the clear?
He's certainly not in the clear in a political sense. We have no information that he is in any kind of legal jeopardy. But this case, particularly the case against Scooter Libby, if he is indeed indicted, goes to the heart of the Bush administration's strategy in selling the war. And much of that strategy was formulated and executed by the vice president and the vice president's office. And if Scooter Libby were to go to trial, their whole strategy and their conduct in the selling of the war will
watch out for the details.
Trial as well.
Dan Kleiman, Newsweek Magazine bureau chief in Washington, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.